tonight I am delighted to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers Sean Esbjørn Hargens, the chair of the Integral Theory Department at JFK University, speaking about his new book, Integral Ecology, Using Multiple Perspectives on the Natural World. I don't know if you like titles or not. Sean or Professor Esbjørn Hargens, Sean is fine, has made substantial contributions to the creation of or the application of integral theory to the area of ecology, and has authored many articles. This new book is just one of many coming out prospectively in the next year or two, I guess.
Yeah, two anthologies, one on integral education and then one on integral theory in the next year.
Well, we're lucky to have you at all here with that kind of schedule. So welcome, Dr. Hargens.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
I have to say, it's so cool to be here, knowing Rob and Stuart for a number of years, and it's nice to be in this store in this context. I've come in and been a good patron and bought a lot of books, so to be a new author and to be presenting my book that I co-authored with Michael Zimmerman is quite a delight, and also in part because, for me, the spiritual dimension of the book is really, in many respects, kind of the core of the work that I do. And so to have my first book presentation to be at Many Rivers, which is a context that really gets and appreciates and celebrates the variety of religious and spiritual traditions and the importance of personal practice, is very meaningful for me to be coming forward with my first book talk out of a number that are lined up here at Many Rivers. So good to see y'all. Thanks for coming out. I want to start by just reading like a page and a half from the beginning of the intro, because I think it really captures an important aspect of the work. So it has the subheading of whose environment is it? So digging in with its forelegs, a beetle extends its maxillary palps to grasp a tasty bit of decaying wood a few centimeters inside a 200-year-old Douglas fir, weakened by age and felled by a windstorm years earlier. A ravenous woodpecker hopping along the tree's carcass in search of insects begins its rapid-fire hammering, which sounds for half a mile or more, perking up its ears at the arboreal anvil chorus. A bear saunters through the stands of cedar and spruce along the way to its favorite valley stream, now rolling with salmon, journeying towards their spawning ponds. Flying in a helicopter over the steep valley formed by glaciers thousands of years ago, a British Columbia forester conducts a survey of conditions in the mid and north coast timber supply area. At midday, a daring photographer moves in close to capture the image of a grizzly one-handedly spearing a salmon that leaps towards the top of the falls. Meanwhile, in a side canyon, a gang uses chainsaws and bulldozers to establish the road needed to haul out trees that will be cut for faraway markets. Some environmental activists staging a sit-in to halt the road building engage in a shouting match with the road crew and loggers. The loggers tell them to go back to the city so that local folks can make a living by doing real work. A local council of First Nation Indigenous people who have long made a living by salmon fishing, announces yet another legal strategy to regain control of their ancestral land. Mountains and streams, plants and animals, burial grounds and ritual sites, the future of which is being contested primarily by descendants of European settlers. A politician in Victoria gets an earful from constituents who differ sharply about logging the coastal rainforest. That evening, on a primetime news program broadcast across the United States, viewers are informed about tense confrontations building over the fate of the Great Bear Rainforest, otherwise known as the Mid and North Coast Timber Supply Area. Those watching easily make the connection between the troubled region and other disappearing rainforests. In another program, an ecosystem scientist uses satellite imagery and GIS to show that the rainforest in question is the size of a small country, that significant portions of it have already been clear-cut, and that within 20 years, at current logging rates, all the old growth will be lumber and plywood for ferocious consumers. Although he is speaking as a supposedly impartial scientist, the ecologist's tone of voice and facial expression give way his deep concern about the future of the rainforest. Which is the real rainforest? The beetles? The woodpeckers? The bears? The foresters? The photographers? The salmon? The road workers, the environmentalists, the loggers? The First Nation members, the politicians? The television viewers? The sawmill workers, the plywood manufacturers, or the ecologists? We maintain that the rainforest is composed of all of these perspectives and many more. This book is about how to organize and integrate all of these perspectives. When I began my graduate studies at the California Institute of Integral Studies, of whom I have two colleagues who are here tonight from those days, I began asking people, how many approaches to the environment do you think there are? And I'd often get responses of, oh, there must be at least a dozen, maybe 20. Every once in a while, someone would, you know, be very daring and suggest maybe 30 or 40 or 50. But no one ever really said a number higher than 50. And I began to document, just making a list and little post-it notes and printing out articles and just kind of keeping track of different approaches that I came across. I began compiling a list with short little definitions of these various approaches. And I assumed that, you know, maybe there'd be 30 or 40. That seemed like a lot, but it seemed realistic given how complex the world is. But it wasn't long before my list actually was over 100. And over the course of about 2 years, I ended up with a list of around 200. And it led me to ask the question, like, how is it that the natural world is such that there are 200 very different perspectives on it, right? And it became quite a kind of koan in the meditation for me, because these different perspectives, many of them have PhD programs, journals, magazines, entire, you know, programs and universities built around them, entire careers and research programs. So they're quite distinct, and yet they don't always agree. In fact, they usually don't. They're highlighting different aspects of reality. And so as I sat with this fact of there being over 200 distinct approaches to the natural world, it just like blew me away. It was just like, whoa. You know, reality, and in this context, ecology or nature, is so complex, so multidimensional. Welcome. So dynamic that we have to have at least 200 approaches to try and capture and speak to and represent that variety. And in the appendix of the book, I list out 200 of the approaches. So as kind of a form of a meditation, let me just read some of the names of them, just so you start to get kind of a flavor for kind of the range of perspectives that I'm talking about. And some of these are major approaches, some are minor, some are emerging. Some of them represent schools of ecology, some represent schools of environmental studies, and some schools of ecological thought. So there's kind of a number of different categories that you could put these in. But it includes things such as acoustic ecology, behavioral ecology, biocultural ecology, biogeochemistry, bioregionalism, biosemiotics, building ecology, business ecology, chaotic ecology, chemical ecology, cognitive ecology, community ecology, conservation ecology, conservation psychology, construction ecology, critical ecology, cultural ecology, cultural landscape studies, cultural theory, deep ecology, design ecology, developmental ethology, developmental systems ecology, dynamic ecology, ecofeminism, ecocriticism, ecolinguistics, also known as linguistic ecology, ecological anthropology, also known as environmental anthropology, ecological archaeology, ecological architecture, ecological communalism, ecological economics, ecological genetics, ecological hermeneutics, ecological modeling, ecological intercorporeality, ecological ontology, ecological phenomenology, ecological philosophy, of course, ecological psychology, ecological rationality, ecological theology, ecopoetics, ecopsychology, ecosystem ecology. I'm glad that one's in there. Environmental aesthetics, environmental communication, environmental education, also known as ecological literacy, environmental ethics, environmental law, environmental optimism, also known as environmental skepticism. Kind of curious that they would be one and the same. Environmental philosophy, environmental pluralism, evolutionary ecology, evolutionary psychology, Gaia theory, general systems theory, geopsychology, also known as psychogeography. I always like that idea, that image of like the landscape just going psycho, you know. Global ecology, also known as planetary ecology, Girthian science, green economics, hierarchy theory, historical ecology, human ecology, industrial ecology, information ecology, integral ecology, then integrated ecology, also known as organic psychology, integrative ecology, also known as interdisciplinary ecology, invasion ecology, landscape ecology, liberation ecology, living systems theory, macroecology, mathematical ecology, media ecology, music ecology, nanoecology, neo-paganism, neo-shamanism, non-dual ecology, nutritional ecology, organizational ecology, paleoecology, also known as ancient ecology, panpsychism, permaculture, physiological ecology, place studies, political ecology, population ecology, process ecology, psychoanalytic ecology, public ecology, reconciliation ecology, also known as win-win ecology, restoration ecology, romantic ecology, sacred geography, sensory ecology, social ecology, socialist ecology, somatic ecology, spatial ecology, spiritual ecology, subtle ecology, systems ecology, terra psychology, theoretical ecology, transcendentalism. Good old Waldo and his pals. Transpersonal ecology, urban ecology, wise use movement, yoga ecology, also known as green yoga and eco yoga. Zoo ethnography, i.e. animal culture. Zoo hermeneutics, i.e. animal interpretation. Zoo phenomenology, i.e. animal experience. And that's not all of them. In the appendix or the 15 additional ones that I've identified since this came out. So just sit with that for a moment. All those crazy labels and terms. And just kind of allow yourself to really kind of feel into this world we live in such that there would be that variety of professional disciplines all articulating some insight about the natural world and our place in it. It's quite overwhelming. It's quite awe-inspiring. And when faced with such a variety and so many kinds of conflicts and misunderstandings that occur because individuals representing those perspectives are coming from different methods, coming from different perspectives, coming from different traditions of inquiry, it's no wonder we're having a hard time solving some of our environmental and ecological issues. And this is just dealing with ecology. I mean, if we brought in economics or law or education or psychology and the many traditions and schools there, you know, it's amazing we're ever able to get much done in this world. One of the interesting things that I've noticed with these different schools is that if you kind of plot them out, like when they first emerged, if you plot them out on a graph, it's basically exponential. That you have about, you know, five of them kind of appearing in the early 1900s, and then around 1950 you have about 15 of them, and then in 1960 it kind of blossoms out, as you can imagine, with about, you know, 30 approaches kind of emerging. 1970s and 80s, then it's like 50, 60 more show up, and then, you know, most of those have been kind of presented or put forward in the last 10 years, which leads me to feel that, well, if the trend is this, then in the next 20, 30, 50 years, like, you know, we're probably going to have 400 distinct perspectives on the natural world. I mean, there's no reason for me, at least, to think it's not going to continue in terms of expanding. I mean, and so it presents us with an interesting situation. How might we really make contact with the insight of these different approaches and bring them to bear, as many of them as possible, or which ones are appropriate to bear on any particular issue or process or effort that we're engaged in as environmentalists, as ecologists, as concerned citizens? You know, so clearly, just drawing on one or two or even five or arguably even a dozen perspectives might be leaving out something, given how many there are. And so, for me, I turn to the work of Ken Wilber and his integral model as a way of holding and organizing and being in relationship with this variety. How many are familiar with Ken Wilber's work? A little bit? Yeah. So, Wilber is an American philosopher, and he's published nearly around 8,000 pages of content over the last 30 years. And in that process has articulated what's referred to as the integral model or integral theory, integral framework. Sometimes it's called AQUAL, which is A-Q-A-L, which is an acronym for All Quadrants, All Levels, which is one way of referring to some key components in his model. But the essential piece that's important for us is that this framework allows one, and in this case me and Michael, to organize this variety of perspectives. One of the foundational components of the integral framework is what's called the four quadrants. And the four quadrants are the result of two distinctions. The distinction between inside and outside. So my interior experience, my emotions, my thoughts, my subjectivity, and then my exterior, my outsides, my behaviors, my physiology, whatever you can see in terms of what I'm wearing or what I'm doing. So kind of the subjective-objective distinction that we're all familiar with. So that's one distinction. The other distinction is between individuals and collectives, and, you know, or the singular and the plural. And what's interesting is, while Wilbur came up with the four quadrants independently as a result of looking at a lot of different approaches and trying to figure out what was a meta pattern that could be used to understand and organize these hundreds of models of reality, what he discovered in that process were there were four basic kinds of maps of reality. There were maps of reality that dealt with psychological and spiritual dimensions. There were maps of reality that dealt with behaviors and physiology and kind of the exterior world, objectivity, things. There were maps of reality that focus on cultural dimensions and dynamics and intersubjectivity and relationship. And then there were maps of reality that focused on systems and how things fit together in different kinds of energy flows or dynamics or configurations. And over the last, 5 years, one of the things I've been keeping track of are individuals who have come up with these same four quadrants on their own, different researchers, theorists, academics. And I've found five independent examples of people saying, hey, look, there's kind of like these four areas that seem to kind of account for a lot. And it seems like they're irreducible to each other. So therefore, if we're going to have a holistic approach, or we're going to really, try and include as much of reality as possible, we definitely need to honor the difference between these four realms and try and understand the methods that are used to explore these realms, and not try and explain one realm through the terms of another realm. In other words, don't try and understand all of psychology just through behavioral studies. Don't try to understand, all of the dynamics of systems through cultural dynamics. Right? So to really understand these distinct phenomenon in the terms in which they're best described. And so on the cover of the book, as just kind of a fun illustration of this, you have the four quadrants, in this case of a frog, right? And because I was trying to come up with a way of how could I represent in a visual manner kind of this position, this insight, that there are four major domains of understanding phenomenon. And so here in the upper right is the exterior behavioral quadrant, and you can see the bones of the frog's skull and then some kind of scientific labeling of what parts of the bone and skull those are. And then in the upper left, which is the domain of experience, you have the frog's eye. It's kind of looking at you. And, the notion of sentience is so undeniable in my experience when you really look in the eye of another creature. It's hard to really deny, for me at least, the fact that this organism, in this case a frog, has some dimension of experience. There's just a kind of a sparkle in the eye, and we know this in so many contexts, that there's something about the eyes that really signals subjectivity, kind of the soul dimension of humans, for instance. And then in the lower left is the cultural dimension, and here you have the frog and some tadpoles and some eggs, and kind of highlighting the family of the frog and some of the intersubjective and even cultural dynamics between members of that species. And then this part was really hard to depict, the lower right, which is the systems quadrant, because in many respects, we don't see the systems aspects. They don't necessarily exist in kind of what's called sensory motor space, or they don't exist kind of in the world, because systems are really understood as like the relationship between parts. And so it's hard to really depict those relationships. And so a lot of times systems theorists will use complex maps with arrows and energy flows and stuff, but that's not really how it looks in the world. It's just a way that we've developed for kind of diagramming these kinds of dynamics. So I ended up going with like the cyborg frog, you know, kind of the electronic robotic frog as a way of kind of highlighting systems realities. And so that just kind of gives you one sense of these quadrants. Now, what I found really interesting was when I grabbed the quadrants and I used them to kind of look at this list of 200 distinct perspectives, interestingly enough, about 50 fell into each of the four quadrants. And so in the upper left, in the experience dimension, you have things like deep ecology, eco-poetics, environmental aesthetics, so approaches that look at kind of our interiors, our psychology, and its relationship to the environment. In the lower left, in the cultural dimension, there's about 50 approaches that focus on intersubjectivity, like ecofeminism or linguistic ecology or historical ecology. And then most of the kind of more traditional schools of ecology that we might think of, whether it's community ecology or landscape ecology or population ecology, or ecosystem ecology or evolutionary ecology, all of those fall on the right-hand side of the quadrants, which are the exterior, so focusing on behaviors and systems. And what was really interesting to me about this was I thought that initially there might be certain areas that were less researched or developed than others. And I assumed that in terms of ecology, that the exterior behavioral systemic dimensions would be the most developed. And in a sense, they are. But what was striking to me was that the interior dimensions, the subjective and the intersubjective, the psychological and the cultural dimensions, that there were dozens and dozens and dozens of approaches, some of which who have been around for, 20, 30, 40 years in developing their methods, developing their analysis, developing their way of talking about interiors and their relationship to ecology and the environment. So it was quite a cool moment for me to realize, one, that of the 200 perspectives, they were quite evenly distributed across this four-quadrant map, and that, two, that there were already people out there who were professionally trained in exploring these domains. And so, in a sense, it kind of relieved me that I didn't need to necessarily go out and kind of try and do that work. Like, if anything, I just needed to help kind of connect some of these perspectives, some of these individuals, some of these disciplines. And so much of the book is about, working with this variety of perspectives and using the framework of the integral model to one, help kind of make sense and hold all of these, but also as a way of kind of creating a shared framework wherein individuals trained in these respective domains can use the integral framework or something similar to it as a way of connecting with each other and sharing insights. So there's three kind of main components to the integral model as presented here in the book. And it's what I refer to as the who times the how times the what. So it's three variables. And this is kind of a simple way of summarizing much of Ken Wilber's more complex thought on this matter. And I've been quite pleased that I was able to come up with a much simpler formula than many of his articulations. And the who refers to the subject, the individual, and the fact that there's multiple worldviews out there, and we often inhabit 2 to 3 different kinds of worldviews, though there tends to be one in which we kind of find ourselves in more often than not. But at any rate, there's different worldviews, and kind of one framework that we use in the book a lot is that there's traditional worldviews, there's modern worldviews, there's postmodern worldviews, and then there's integral worldviews. Now, what's interesting about traditional, modern, and postmodern worldviews is they tend to view the other two worldviews as quite misguided, and they tend to kind of bicker back and forth, so the, you know, and in a way it kind of breaks into kind of government agencies, business, and nonprofits. That's a simplistic articulation, but there's a lot to that. That there's certain kinds of structures, social structures that kind of embody and illustrate these worldviews more than others, and that's kind of one way of thinking about it. And what's unique about an integral worldview in relationship to the others is that, unlike the traditional modern postmodern worldviews, which spend a lot of time in many cases trying to discredit or highlight how misguided the different approaches are, the integral worldview really wants to highlight the strengths and the limits of each of those three worldviews, and really wants to try and bring the insights and the value of the different worldviews together. Whereas, you know, it's pretty common to see environmentalists who are pretty anti-business, you know, anti-capitalism, or postmodern individuals who are anti-Republican or anti-Christian, and vice versa, conservative Christians who are very suspicious of business, or, you know, hate those darn liberals, and, you know, like, so there's a lot of that kind of dynamic in our society, in ourselves even, in our communities, and the integral worldview really wants to highlight that there's healthy and unhealthy expressions of those different worldviews, both individually and collectively. And also what's interesting is different schools of ecology come out of and represent those different worldviews. And some schools can be a mixture of two or three worldviews, but it's not uncommon in looking at the variety of worldviews, schools of ecology that I read through, that some of them are more postmodern in their orientation, highlighting subjective dimensions, and often kind of intersubjective dimensions. The more modern approaches tend to be the more scientific in the traditional sense, highlighting the behavioral and systemic aspects. The traditional approaches tend to emphasize kind of managerial or utilitarian dimensions of ecology or environmental efforts. So that's the first variable, the who, which is just to highlight that there's different worldviews out there. And then the second piece is the how. And this is highlighting that there are lots of different methodologies. You can use chemical analysis, you can use statistical analysis, you can use surveys, you can do interviews, you can observe animals in natural settings, you can do cultural anthropological studies of how different cultures relate to the natural world. You can do different kinds of meditation to connect with the natural world, or to understand people's deeper motivations, or how they're holding the divine in relationship to the natural world. You know, so there's a lot of different methodologies that can be used to understand and to make contact with the natural world. And one of the things that I really love about integral ecology or integral theory is that, for me, it's really about intimacy with reality. You know, so I went through that a list of many of those 200 perspectives, which is kind of like, whoa, wow, that's a lot. And yet, for me, there's something about kind of being in relationship, kind of being in witness to that variety, and working with a model that allows me to try and include the insights of as many of those approaches as possible. For me, there's something about contact with reality. It facilitates my contact with reality. And there's kind of a quality of intimacy. So it's like the more perspectives I can appreciate, the more perspectives I can understand or have a relationship to and include those in my efforts, then there's a way in which I feel like I'm making more contact with reality. And there's something very powerful in that for me. So the different methodologies, and the integral theory identifies 8 major methodological camps, and which have fancy names like hermeneutics and cultural anthropology and empiricism and phenomenology and systems theory, just to kind of give you a flavor of some of the language and distinctions. So there's 8 major methodological families in which traditions over the last 2,000 years have used these various forms of knowing, of inquiry and data collection, and to understand phenomena, to understand reality. And so that's the how. So you have the who, you have individuals with different worldviews who take up different methods in different contexts to understand reality. And then there's the what. And the what is reality, like the different aspects of reality that you can look at or take as object. So in a sense, the who is the subject, the what is the object, and then the how is how the subject interacts with the object, right? So the what, in a sense, is the four quadrants. That reality, different aspects of reality have these four major dimensions. There's subjective dimensions, there's intersubjective dimensions, there's objective dimensions, there's systems or interobjective dimensions. So we as subjects can look at those aspects of reality, kind of from like an analytical stance. So what integral ecology and what integral theory is saying is it's not just enough to realize kind of how complex reality is out there, that actually what's out there is the result of a subject taking up a practice or a method or an injunction or a technique, the how. So a subject, the who, taking up a practice, the how, and then making contact with the what. So that there's this actual, there's like this really dynamic relationship between the who, the how, and the what. And you actually can't understand any one of those dimensions without understanding or having a sense of the other two. Right? And the sense is that those three kind of co-create each other. That there's something about the individual using certain practices to look at certain aspects of reality that generate what's then called reality out there. So, for instance, and you see this, you can see this like if you have a traditional worldview, an individual with a traditional worldview, that's focused primarily on kind of managerial or utilitarian dimensions of, you know, stewardship, if you will. And they use a certain technique or method, such as statistical analysis, to look at a population of, you know, deer, for instance. So the who is traditional worldview. The how is... what did I say? Did I say statistical method, looking at a population of deer? So those three variables are going to work together to create whatever the data or the phenomenon under study is. And there's going to be certain recommendations about that population of deer that are the result of a statistical approach and are the result of a traditional worldview around conservation. Well, that's a very different dynamic than if you take a postmodern kind of radical environmentalist and they use a phenomenological method or an introspective method, like an inquiry process of connecting within to understand their relationship to the larger cosmos. Right? So the who is radical postmodern environmentalist, the how is a meditative kind of inquiry, and the what is my place in the larger cosmos, in a sense of, you know, oneness with all that is in Earth's arising. So who's right? I mean, it's quite an odd question, right? Isn't it? Like, which of those is true? Like, in a way, it doesn't. It's like that kind of question doesn't even make sense in relationship to those choices. It's not that either is true or false. It's that each is a different combination of a who and a how and a what. And those who, hows, and whats get together in different combinations and different insights are produced. Different understandings are generated. Different recommendations are put forth. And so when I started using this framework to make sense of the 200 methods or the 200 schools, excuse me, what I started to see was, well, no wonder there's at least 200. Because if there's three or four or five major worldviews, and you times that by the eight major methodologies, and you times that by the four major quadrants, or if you want to get really crazy and look at body, mind, and spirit in each of the four quadrants so that you have a 12 quadrant, you know, representation, then it's like 5 times 8 times 12. You know, I'm not good at math, but I'll say that adds up very quickly to, you know, around 200 or over 200.
480. Oh, thank you, Elmer. Amazing. You know, and so it's a quite a fascinating kind of way of holding this multiplicity. And obviously it's just one way, you know, and there's a lot of different ways to work with this variety. But what's cool for me is that, you know, there are over 50 individuals out there in the world who are using this framework to do ecological work and environmental work, and they're producing amazing results and having a lot of success in bringing together diverging and often conflicting perspectives at the table. And in the book, there's actually three case studies at the end by different individuals other than Michael and myself that present how they use this framework in different areas. One is by a marine ecologist in Hawaii, and he's looking at the conflict in Hawaii around the reefs between the aquarium industry, who want to go collect the, in particular, the yellow tangs, the particular kind of ornamental fish. So the aquarium industry, the tourists who want to go out and snorkel and see the amazing, beautiful fish, and then the native Hawaiians who want to make certain claims on those reef areas for fishing and for, you know, a variety of purposes related to their culture and religion and so forth. So he's caught, his name is Brian Tissett, is caught, in the case study at least, kind of in the middle of these three conflicting approaches and kind of their associated worldviews, their different methods. And he uses the integral model presented in the book as a way of navigating through that territory and with some really cool results. Another example is Darcy Riddell, who has a case study in the book, and she's looking at the Great Bear Rainforest, which was actually what inspired the opening paragraphs there that I read. And she's dealing with even a much more complex situation up in Canada, in British Columbia, with First Nation peoples, with the big box companies like Home Depot and kind of the lumber industry and a lot of international economic realities, the British Columbia government, Canadian government, and, you know, their rules and regulations around logging, and then a lot of the environmentalists and a lot of the business, you know, so it's like a very complex space that she worked in as an activist for many years and still is doing some work there. And she used the integral model to really help work with these different worldviews, really understand and appreciate where people were coming from, the insight and value of what they're presenting, and ways of working with the kind of more contracted and kind of feisty aspects of people in these situations. You know, because when you feel like your position's not being seen, you tend to kind of dig in, right? You know, and you get a little riled up, and then it's really hard to see the value of these other perspectives because you're really, you know, concerned that your own perspective and what you think should be valued and addressed is not being addressed. And so, you know, there's some really cool examples at all kinds of scales from, you know, local communities like Sebastopol, actually, now that I'm mentioning it. A JFK student, I teach at John F. Kennedy University in the East Bay, did his master's degree here in Sebastopol, his project, his final thesis, looking at the pepperweed issue and looking at and he identified the five or six major worldviews that were represented in the pepperweed controversy. Is anyone familiar with and remember, and it's still kind of an issue? And so he met with city council folks, he met with individuals who went out and volunteered to pull the pepperweed, he met with, you know, just a wide variety of individuals from very conservative to neo-pagans to, you know, business folks in the area to really understand their views on this environmental issue in Sebastopol and wrote up an amazing 100-page thesis kind of looking at that and looking at the who, the how, and the what. You know, it's a way of making sense of it. And what's cool about the who, how, what is by understanding kind of these variables, you can start to identify kind of the leverage points. You can start to figure out what's missing and therefore how to include it. You can also identify the different kinds of relationships between some of the variables, and it really can open up a whole new kind of discourse around what might next steps be because you're taking a really big picture view. So let me just say a few more things and then kind of shift to Q&A and kind of just hearing from you how any of this has landed, what kind of questions you have, insights or comments. And that is just to kind of give you a sense of the book. As you can tell, it's quite a big book, and I often joke that it makes a really good doorstop. So you guys might consider that, you know, if you're trying to keep the door open. I spent 10 years working on this. So, you know, it's amazing to think that, you know, a decade of my life has gone into this. And I was in Africa working with Peace Corps in Chad, which is quite a challenging place to be for 3 years, you know, in sub-Sahara Africa. And while I was there, I was, you know, dealing with a lot of, conflicting perspectives. You know, there was, you know, the you know, American versus African. There was the male and female. There was the Buddhist and, you know, the missionaries. So there was a lot of different dynamics like that. Not to mention that in the town that I lived in, there were 12 major languages spoken, and in the country there were 200 languages. And so when I would go to the market, I'd often have to speak in Arabic and French and some of the local dialects to try and barter for tomatoes. So it was in Africa that I first read a book by Ken Wilber on integral theory, and I found it so helpful with kind of helping me make sense of a lot of the dynamics, cultural dynamics that I was experiencing. And I was studying environmental philosophy at the time, and it was in that moment when I finished reading his book that I basically said, well, integral ecology, like I coined that term in my head. It wasn't a phrase that Wilber had used, and in fact, I don't even think he had necessarily used the phrase integral in what I had read in an explicit sense. But basically from Africa, I finished up my time there and I came back and went to CIS in San Francisco. And as soon as I landed at the California Institute of Integral Studies, I knew that I wanted to work in integral ecology. And so I wrote every single paper, 40 out of 46 papers on integral ecology. So for 6 years of graduate studies, I used every opportunity I could to write about and try and articulate and kind of figure out what is it that I want to say in trying to present an integrative approach to these many perspectives on the natural world. And Michael Zimmerman, who's a well-known environmental philosopher, was teaching at Tulane, and I asked him to be on my committee, one of three individuals on my dissertation. And so when I finished my dissertation, I turned to Michael and said, well, how about a book? You know, let's co-author a book. And we'll use my dissertation, but we'll build on it. You know, we'll add some stuff on each side of it. So there's four parts in this book, and part two is essentially my dissertation. The other, Michael largely wrote part one because it's the philosophical part, and he being the environmental philosopher, that was obviously the contribution that he could make so fully. So part one is kind of the philosophical groundwork, looking at a lot of issues of like nature versus culture, interiors versus exteriors, and just some of the major kind of issues in environmental studies and environmental ethics and environmental philosophy, and kind of situating our approach within that kind of larger discourse. Part two deals with the theoretical framework of the who times the how times the what, which is my dissertation, and gives examples and talks about it, both in terms of one of the major contributions, as I see it, that integral ecology is making is it's including interiors into ecological science and into environmental studies. And it does this in two ways. One is by recognizing human interiors, human psychology, human culture, and how a deeper and wider understanding of those dimensions is going to help us with issues like climate change, with wetland preservation, and, you know, any number of environmental efforts. So human psychology, in a sense, is one big piece. The other piece is animal consciousness, including the interiors of organisms. And this is something that ecological science is quite silent on, understandably, given the methods that they generally use. The methods they generally use do not disclose consciousness of organisms. But there are many traditions of studying animals that do look at the consciousness, the subjectivity, the experience, the emotions, the sensation, the basic and even complex capacity of organisms to perceive and experience. And it's actually one of the areas that I'm most interested in, is animal consciousness. And integral ecology provides a framework and a way of traditional ecologists to begin including more understanding of the interiors of organisms. And I'll tell a cool story about that in just a moment as a way of wrapping up before we go to Q&A. So that's part two. It kind of looks at animals and their interiors and then humans and their interiors and how this framework of who times how times what can support us in holding all of these 200 approaches. Part three then gets into more applications. It looks at nature mysticism and does a really cool piece on kind of the varieties of nature mysticism that result from or that can be understood using the integral framework. And we get some cool examples. And then looks at climate change and also just the notion of an ecological crisis and how does our understanding of a crisis change in the face of a framework like this. And because there's what French thinker Edgar Morin calls there's a polycrisis. There's not just a single crisis, but there's actually multiple crises. And in some cases they overlap and in other cases they don't. And part of it is because we have different worldviews, and so we make sense of the crisis or crises in very different ways. So, for instance, using the traditional, the three worldviews, traditional, modern, postmodern, the crisis from a traditional worldview is generally thought of as a crisis of management and stewardship, and we need better laws, we need better regulations, we need better enforcement. Whereas the crisis of modernism in the ecological context is usually thought of as markets, free markets, and economic dynamics, and political realities, and transnational agreements, and greening our economies and things like that. Whereas the postmodern worldview tends to highlight biodiversity as the crisis, or social injustices, as the crisis or the result of the crises. And obviously, all of those are crises that we're having. But different worldviews will tend to highlight, emphasize, and in some cases even deny the validity of some of those other kinds of crises. Part three also gets into 18 personal practices that you can do to work with your awareness to cultivate and develop an integral sensibility for yourself, right? Because it was real important for Michael and I, because we tend to be these kind of philosophical, theoretical types. And one of the important things that integral theory highlights is that it's not enough to have a good theory. Like, you really have to have a good practice. You have to have a yoga. You have to have a way of exercising yourself, your embodiment, your consciousness, your perception. You have to have a way of working with that, challenging it, opening it, deepening it, that in a way that really facilitates you being an embodiment of the theory or the philosophy that you're espousing. So it was real important for us to have a whole chapter devoted to, as I said, 18 different practices, many of which are based on or versions of simple meditation practices that are associated with our various traditions, but situated in an environmental context. And then there's a chapter that presents, I think, 35 different examples of integral ecology being used in the world. So that's part three. Part four is the case studies and the conclusion, and then there's the appendix. So that kind of gives you kind of a gestalt of the book. So let me just end with this story that I think is quite helpful in illustrating the potential of integral ecology. So in East Africa, a few years back, there were a number of incidences where elephants trampled and killed humans. And, in Kenya and Uganda and in East Africa, there's ongoingly since the 60s and 70s when they made national parks, there's been conflicts between elephants and crops and humans. And so it's not uncommon that they come into contact and there's some issues. But it is uncommon for elephants to kill humans. They just don't tend to do that.
They're social, they're intelligent, and that's a very uncommon thing to have happen. And so when it occurred numerous times in a short period of time, they decided to bring together the field biologists, the different ecologists working in the different national parks and associated with where these incidences had occurred. And they brought them all together, and the park rangers and a variety of folks who would have some insight into trying to figure this out. And, you know, over the course of a number of days and maybe even weeks or months, what they ended up realizing was, like, one, all the incidences involved adolescent male elephants. So, like, okay, that's an interesting pattern. So what else? You know, like, you know, they can kind of feel like, okay, so teenagers, especially male teenagers, can have extra aggression and be a bit, you know, acting out and so forth. So that, you know, we can kind of get behind that. There's a kind of intuitive connection there. But it's not enough to really explain the violence of these incidences and the frequency of them. Then they started to realize, holy smokes, every one of these elephants, these young adolescent rogue elephants, witnessed their parents being slaughtered by poachers. It's like, wow, that's very interesting. Now, if you're a traditional ecologist, you don't know what to do with that, right? Because the implications of that are psychological and emotional. It's trauma. These elephants have been traumatized by watching their parents being killed brutally by poachers. So when they made that connection, then they started looking at the evidence, the signs, the symptoms, the behavioral dynamics, and they started realizing, wow, these elephants are demonstrating all of the signs of post-traumatic stress syndrome. Every one of them. The signs are right there. So then they basically had to pull in psychologists who work with trauma cases with humans and who are experts in post-traumatic stress syndrome to bring them in to try and understand what's going on with these elephants and how might we work with it, how might we rehabilitate them. And so they brought in a host of different kinds of psychologists from different fields and different people who worked with animals in some similar kinds of contexts. And they developed a rehabilitation program that's been pretty successful. And there's actually a woman, Guy Bradshaw, who is in California, who's developed this whole approach called trans-species psychology that connects with this. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that if we just look at comparative anatomy with elephants, like, we know that they're extremely smart and intelligent and that they're quite a complex, intelligent, dynamic species, but in terms of comparative anatomy, they have a larger limbic system than humans do comparatively, right? So one way we can think of that is that they have a more complex, potentially emotional capacity than humans do, right? And so this is one of the interesting things that starts to emerge when you do comparative anatomy and you triangulate that with some of the insights from the different traditions that are associated with those four quadrants that I talked about before. And you can start to appreciate and see, like, wow, like, okay, for a human to watch their parents being slaughtered, that's going to be pretty emotionally damaging. But if it is the case that elephants' limbic system, their emotional center, is arguably more complex than ours, maybe that kind of trauma would be even more impactive than it would be on humans. Because we know that the bonding between you know, young elephants and their parents is quite complex and lasts for many years, very similar to human relationships. So this just gives you a sense of how ecologists, integral ecologists, who not only understand the science of ecology, but also understand the interiors of ecology, can do important, valuable ecological work by recognizing the interiors as well as the exteriors, recognizing the behavioral and systemic aspects as well as the psychological and cultural aspects. Because elephants, for example, have very dynamic cultures. There's a lot of fascinating work being done on animal culture. I
I mean, it'll blow you away. And if we had another hour, I would talk about it. So let me just stop there. But before we go to Q&A, let's just take a minute of silence to just kind of let all that in, because I've been yakking. So just to kind of let in and just be in relationship to everything that I've spoken to, see what kinds of questions or curiosities or comments that might arise within your own awareness, your own embodied experience, as we just take a moment to kind of shift and drop in. So we'll go ahead and open it up to your reflections and comments. And I don't need or necessarily want this to be kind of a back and forth just with me. Like, I'd love to see conversation and crosstalk and just like to have it to be a really dynamic space in whatever way that shows up. So feel free to participate in that fashion if it seems appropriate. Yeah, please, in the back, and then you in the front.
I had an impulse to say, I'm an animal, so I can tell you anything you want to know about animal consciousness. The name of nature is very important to me. I like saying that nature is the ongoing conversation between everything and everything else. Mm. Couldn't have a thought unless nature allowed it. Mm. Couldn't have an idea. Couldn't have all of these different categories. Couldn't separate things into different categories. Mm. Unless nature allowed it. Thanks for the pause. I really needed it.
Mm. Yeah.
The whole conceptual arena, it can turn into a kind of a trap. Its specialty is making divisions, making separations, and to go there without that way of finding our way back to, again, to the unity, can be dangerous. I call it shutting down the conceptual brain.
Yeah.
And practice. Nature is a practice.
It's fine.
Yeah.
No, it's what you've said so far has been a great share.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Is there more?
There might be.
Okay.
Okay. If we come up with two fingers, then.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thanks. Yeah. You here in the front?
I'm interested in the process of deciding when you're about to begin to look for situations to apply the integral approach to. I'm interested in the process of deciding what the problem is what problems are in any area, and what the figures of merit are in making things better.
Right.
And as you have already demonstrated, there are many different points of view. And when you first asked the question about how many different approaches, I thought, well, I'll say, how many species are there on the planet? What's good for one species is what appears to be good for one species may be the result of members of that species sacrificing.
Uh-huh.
It's incredibly complex. And I'm just wondering how you go about deciding what's important and how you know you're on the right track.
Yeah. No, it's great. One of the points that we make in the book, and which I feel is unique to integral ecology, I haven't seen this position in other environmental approaches, and that is, from the get-go, regardless of what you do in terms of environmental action or ecological action or analysis, that for me, an integral ecologist recognizes from the very beginning that what you're about to do or what you're doing likely has ill consequences that you cannot imagine or foresee or make sense of in the moment or maybe in your lifetime. Because there's so many examples of, you know, people doing good ecological work in the 1920s that in the 1940s turned out to be disastrous, you know? And so to have a kind of a quality of humbleness of like, I'm going to give it my best shot with the information I have, and because I feel compelled to act, I feel compelled to try and make things better, you know, particularly on behalf of conflicting perspectives where people are wanting some kind of resolution or you know, agreement or configuration that's less suffering. And so I'm going to participate in this process because I don't want to just sit back. But I realize that I'm quite limited, and what might look like a good idea, and might a lot of people might agree it's a good idea, and we might do it and it appears successful. It maybe from some perspective or at some point down the road, we might know otherwise. And so to always have that very close to oneself, to avoid the kind of hubris that's so common in environmental action, where here's the right way, we just got to get everyone on board, let's figure out how to do that, you know. And you mentioned species. In the book, we point out that there's actually 26 different concepts as to what a species is. There's no agreement. No one knows what a species is. 26 different concepts. Now, some of them are a little fringe, but they're being used by ecologists and evolutionary theorists and so forth. And so even if we just say, well, okay, let's just pick the 6 really good ones, then we still don't know what a species is.
Who gets to pick?
Right, exactly. So that's one dimension. The other is that integral ecology doesn't provide a procedure. It doesn't say this is what you need to do in order for it to be integral. Rather, it says here are some interesting distinctions that seem to be important and valuable when one is trying to bring together conflicting views, different perspectives, different kinds of knowledge, and it provides a way of working with that complexity. And so what might be an integral outcome in one community might not be an integral outcome in another community. And so it's situational in that, you know, you really have to work with the stakeholders in the community and try and work with those perspectives. But another key thing that you highlight is the issue of species, that so often I see environmentalists pretending, and I'm being a bit pejorative in that, pretending to be ventriloquists for species and for plants and for the planet. Now, I do feel that there are ways in which we can speak on behalf of species or plants or the planet in general. But I feel like we have to be careful in how we go about that. And there's a lot of people who don't engage in a process that I feel qualifies them to do that in any global sense, you know, to make strong claims about the planet. The planet wants this, or the planet needs that. Well, usually when you hear those kind of statements, that's the individual wants that. The individual needs that. And that's not to say there isn't some truth to what they're pointing to in terms of our problems and potential solutions. But I think we have to be very careful in speaking on behalf of others, whether it's other humans, other individuals in our communities, or other species. So those are important issues that we don't resolve in the book, but that we do address and do hold in the way that I've been speaking.
Are there any kind of ethical principles that have anything to do with the integral ecology?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a couple layers to that. One is there is an environmental ethic that we outline, but we don't spend a lot of time fleshing it out, and that's just work that remains to be done. But we hold a triadic approach to environmental ethics that says that there's ground value, there's intrinsic value, and there's extrinsic value. To give a quick example, if we're faced with the question, who's more important, ants or humans, right? Then different approaches to environmental philosophy have said the following three things. They've said, well, they're both equal. They're both perfect expressions of spirit, expressions of the biosphere, expressions of ecological realities. We can't judge. They're just equal expressions of life, spirit manifest. So that's been one position that's been argued and outlined. Often deep ecologists historically have taken that kind of position. Another position is, well, the ant's more important, because actually ants comprise 10% of the biomass of the entire planet, which is more than any other single species. And in fact, if ants somehow disappeared or were compromised in some major way, the rest of the planet would basically decompose in about 8 months. So that the ants are fundamentally more important to the ecosystem than humans are. Humans are just like kind of the whipped cream or cherry on top. The planet can do with us or do without us. But ants are fundamental to...
Some people might say it's something other than whipped cream or a cherry.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and they have. Yeah. Cancerous growth or a tumor. And then the other position is, well, humans. Because humans have such a rich, complex interior. And that's not to say ants don't possibly have some kind of basic proprioception or sensory capacity, but humans can love and they can hate and they can dance and there's joy and they can make contact with the divine, and like there's just this rich reality that comes alive, and that the human actually is an expression of heaven and earth coming together. And so those are very different kind of ethical positions, and what integral ecology says is all three are right. And so in the literature around environmental philosophy and ethics, you see this bickering of people saying, no, no, the humans are better. And others saying, no, no, the ants are better. And I'm simplifying their arguments, but the essential dynamic is they're digging into one of these three perspectives, and they're largely saying the other two are wrong. And what integral ecology comes along and says, well, you just have to be clear which context you're highlighting. Are you highlighting ground value? Ground value is that all things are equally valuable. And that's an important ethical perspective. Or are you highlighting something that's more fundamental? Because if you're highlighting fundamental, then humans are out the door. But if you're highlighting significance, and significance here is a technical term that we talk about, then humans would be, or cows would be more significant than ants, that kind of thing. So you have to be clear about what is the context from which you're speaking or standing, and you want to avoid category mistakes, and so that's just one way of trying to hold the diversity and saying, if you're trying to make an ethical decision ecologically, try and be aware of those three different ethical values and dimensions, and you might choose one over the other two in any given situation, but be aware that you're doing that, right? And try and have a good criteria or justification for doing that.
The last point,
yeah,
is
right.
Very much up to the chooser.
Yeah, or the community of choosers, yeah.
I mean, you can use rationality to back into almost anything.
No, it's true. Yeah.
So, who is being trained to bring the community together, sit at the table together, and hear all these perspectives?
Say more about who, like, and trained. Like,
who,
what do you have
in
mind when you ask?
Are you saying that people who go into integrative ecology are being trained on that grounded level of, okay, we have some training, experience, knowledge to bring all these perspectives together and talk with each other?
Yeah, at this point, because integral ecology is so new, you know, it's, and Michael and I began working on kind of articulating it, you know, about 5 years ago. I mean, well, 10 years ago, but it wasn't until about 5 years ago that we published certain pieces and people started kind of resonating with what we were doing and started using some of it. And so at this point, kind of in terms of where it's at as a discipline or an approach, is that individuals, leaders, usually in different communities, and, you know, whether they're urban designers or ecologists or environmental activists or landscape architects, all these kinds of individuals who are already in communities, already engaged in projects that generally have conflicting stakeholders in at different phases of those projects, and who have developed capacities to try and work with and navigate that, then find this, learn about this framework, and then it just supports kind of what they're already trying to do. And so at this point, people are getting their training either on the job, so to speak, or just through other kinds of traditional training processes that support one in being a mediator in a sense. But integral ecology as a field isn't established enough to where that piece is an explicit piece of kind of becoming an integral ecologist.
Do you see that as part of that?
Yeah, I definitely have a sense that that will increasingly become the case. It's not clear to me if it will be centralized in some fashion, like through a particular training school or program, or if it'll be kind of how it is now, kind of, you know, democratized in that there'll just be an understanding that to do this kind of work, you really have to get some training in multi-stakeholder processes. And there's a lot of different models and techniques and tools out there for multi-stakeholder processes, you know, appreciative inquiry and, you know, so forth. A lot of, you know, individuals working in community development have developed quite an array of these kinds of methods and techniques. And so there might be maybe an identification of what seem to be some of the better tools and processes and techniques that integral ecologists have used and are finding valuable. So there might be kind of a comparing of notes, so to speak, and maybe an identification of certain kinds of mediation that seem to work well with this approach.
Yeah. So, Sean, you said when you were in Africa, you know, you had the first thought of integral ecology. So I'm just wondering, you know, were you an ecologist at that point, and were you already feeling some kind of fracturing or conflicting viewpoints that were you already feeling that at that point?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, as an undergrad, let me just back up. I grew up in the coast of Oregon, Coos Bay, and did a lot of hunting and fishing with my dad, and spent a lot of time picking mushrooms and being outside and photographing nature. So I grew up in a very kind of nature-rich environment, and I often wanted to be a biologist or a zoologist or a nature photographer or even a taxidermist at one point. When I went to college, I got involved with the outdoor program, and so I began leading trips, outdoor education, backpacking, sea kayaking, and I tried to triple major in philosophy, psychology, and biology because I was studying animal consciousness. And when I left for Peace Corps, I was planning on coming back and entering a program in philosophy of biology and focusing on animal consciousness. So I've always been on the more philosophical side, the humanity side, and less the scientific or strictly ecological side. And when I was in Africa, you have a lot of time to read. And I'm a bibliophile by nature anyways. And so before I encountered Wilbur's work, I had literally just spent the previous 2 years reading 200 books. Many of them were on environmental philosophy, ecology, and related topics. And I was experiencing fragmentation. I was frustrated with the deep ecologists, arguing with the ecofeminists, arguing with the systems theorists, arguing with the managerial stewardship approaches, arguing with the systems ecology. You know, like, I was kind of frustrated. It's just like, you know, because I could see value in all of them. And it didn't make sense to me why there wasn't kind of more integration. And when I read Wilbur's work for the first time, I had what I call an intellectual satori. Like, I went into this altered state and was just like, wow. Because all of a sudden, these 200 books I just read for 2 years, plus my previous training as an undergrad in philosophy, biology, and psychology, like, all of a sudden it was like this big heap of stuff in my mind. All of a sudden I went, you know, and I was just kind of like, whoa, you know, like, wow, like, so there were like there was a kind of connective tissue that Wilbur's model brought to me that allowed me to hold the variety and the complexity. And as I said, and your point in the back was really important around the conceptual discrimination, had the shadow side of that is actually fragmentation and a lack of, you know, being in touch with reality, which is why for me it's important to highlight how working with the conceptualizations, and there's many in this book, it's quite theoretical, quite philosophical, quite mental in that sense, but working with those in a way that actually is about intimacy with reality. It's about being in direct contact with phenomenon, with the natural world, and to really try and find that integration between the power of the mind and discrimination and the embodied heart and grounded body that's in immediate contact with its surrounding, and to really find a way to bring that together. Because in Africa, as I was sitting in my mud hut reading all these books, that was not lined up. And there was a lot of conflict internally for me. And Wilbur's work began a process of a deep integration between those dimensions of myself.
How did you get all those books into a hut?
Well, I realized before I went... when I was an undergrad at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, I was in Kenya and Uganda for 6 months in an overseas program. And while Nairobi had a bookstore, it wasn't a very good bookstore, but I also traveled to a few other countries, and I realized that Africa doesn't have bookstores, and not very good ones, and at least in terms of what I wanted to read. And this was before Amazon existed, right? So when I was going to Chad, I realized I can buy a toothbrush in Africa. I can buy underwear. I can buy sunglasses. I can buy pretty much everything I need. But I can't buy books. So I used my 100-pound limit of baggage. I took a little bag of clothes and personal belongings, and I took books. And then at the year-and-a-half mark, I flew to Paris to meet a friend who brought from my house some pre-packed suitcases of books with her. I exchanged. It was like I felt like I was Jack Bauer for a moment there, or James Bond. It was like I exchanged a suitcase of books. She handed me a suitcase of books, you know, and we hung out in Paris for a couple of days, and I said, thanks for the books, see ya. And I went back with my books. And then actually, after I read Brief History of Everything, which was the first book by Wilbur, it blew me away. And I realized that it was a summary of a much larger book called Sex, Ecology, Spirituality, which is the same size as this. And so I used my remaining vacation days to fly home to Portland, Oregon, to Powell's bookstore, and buy 20 books, including this additional book by Wilbur. And because I made a list of the 20 books I needed to read before I could read Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. Like, it was self-imposed homework. And I had to read these books. I had to read Whitehead. I had to read Kant. I had to read Foucault. I had to read some more deep ecology. I had to read some, you know, stuff on religious this and that. And so then I came back to Africa with those books. I read those 20 books. And then I sat down in my hut for 14 days, 8 hours a day, and I read Sex, Ecology, Spirituality.
So that's my craziness. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Then interesting. When I left my trip in Africa, I actually ended up going to India and Asia for a while. But then when I landed back in the States, I timed it so I landed in San Francisco the same day that there was an open house at California Institute of Integral Studies, and I marched up to the program I was interested in and got the information and basically applied at that point.
Wow, you're very dedicated.
Yeah. How are we doing on time?
It's about 9.
Okay.
So, if there's a concluding remark or something like that.
Yeah.
I want to make one remark. If we can find one more person in the universe with your willingness, then maybe there's some possibility.
Thank you. But I really appreciate your attempt to this. I've really felt like a real nice quality of listening and engagement from each of you tonight. And it's very meaningful to me, and happy to connect with any of you for a few moments afterwards. And I live locally. There's a bookmarks. You can take a number of them if you want. There's a website, integralecology.org, where you can get more info. And then there's also just these kind of postcards that have a blurb on the back and a short summary you can take. And I brought two different kinds of articles. Both of these are on the website, so if you want to get them later, you can go to the website and get them, or if I happen to run out of either one of them, you can go there. One is the 15-page overview of this 850-page book, and so it can give you kind of a quick synopsis, and Michael and I put together, and we tried to make it much more accessible than the more academic version here. And you'll have to be the judge of that. For us philosophical types, we think we did a good job, but I'm sure there's room for improvement. So there's that 15-page overview, and then there's a longer, it's like 24-page overview of integral theory that I did. So if you're interested in Wilbur's work, or want to get a deeper sense of kind of the components to it, this is a really good piece to check out.
Is that one also on the website?
Yeah, they both are on the Integral Ecology website. And you can download them and you can share them with other people. So I'll leave the ecology one there on top of the ecology book because they look very similar. And I'll leave the integral theory one here. So many blessings to you. Have a great evening and a good weekend coming up. And thanks for coming out tonight.
Thank you.
Many rivers. I want to thank you for a wonderful, delightful sharing of intellectual and other intimacies. Mm. That was very nice and very much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, I also want to point out, as my duty, that we have a Donna donation bowl over on the counter over there, and we hope that you will offer some intimacy to that bowl from your pocket, and allow us to continue to offer these events here at the store, and that we share with speakers to further their own work if they wish. And thank you all for coming tonight, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the busy month of July.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks.